SCP-7291. Ge is for Gesundheit. Superstitions have influenced humanity since the dawn of our species. Knocking on wood, avoiding black cats and walking under ladders, holding a rabbit's foot for luck, wishbones, Friday the 13th, and breaking mirrors. Humans have come up with countless ways that they believe will bring them great fortune or misfortune. Ordinarily, these small beliefs don't cause much harm, as most people don't really care if you avoid walking under a ladder, but occasionally these things can spiral out of control. SCP-7291 is a tale of superstitions running awry in an already dire situation, featuring a large cast of characters and plenty of misfortune. Let us begin. SCP-7291 is a tomb in the Pinsk Marshes in Belarus, near the Pripyat River. A rough map and architectural summary were recovered from the files of a drone technician, DaCosta, after Incident 7291-1. In the summary, DaCosta states that the tomb is constructed entirely below grade, accessed via a narrow aperture in an inconspicuous natural rock feature. The primary structure is a series of bedrock chambers, with obvious tool markings indicating that they were carved by humans or human-adjacent hands. The descent to these chambers is composed of Makrana white marble, as the marsh soil cannot effectively be tunneled. This material doesn't occur naturally in Belarus, and must have been imported from the Indian subcontinent. Though Makrana marble is non-porous, and the bedrock is solid, neither material should be impenetrable by the surrounding marsh. Nevertheless, the tomb contains no standing water, and the walls do not leak. The layout of the tomb consists of a descending access passage with multiple switchbacks and blind corners, a wide forecourt with an entrance to the tomb proper, an outer chamber and inner chamber, an outer and inner burial chamber, and an extensive series of interconnected tunnels. Exploration of the tunnels has yet to be completed, and over 20 kilometers of tunnel have thus far been mapped. The burial chambers are irregular, rough-hewn structures, each containing a single, undecorated sarcophagus and several niches obscured with rough plaster, which may or may not contain burial paraphernalia. The sarcophagus in the outer burial chamber was opened before the Foundation discovered the tomb, and the sarcophagus in the inner burial chamber, the lid of which is flush with the stone floor, was opened subsequently. We're surprisingly not given the description of the tomb's anomalous effect, with a Reza note telling us that the description has been deferred until the nomination of a new research team for this file, and completion of an internal affairs investigation into the two incidents. The tomb came to the Foundation's attention in September of 2022, after a series of unorthodox actions on the part of professional archaeologist Dr. Baris Salavi. Salavi was on a Foundation watch list after inadvertently uncovering an anomalous ruin beneath a building site in Minsk in 2010. Despite repeated amnestization, Salavi continued to sporadically encounter esoteric materials unknown to the Foundation or mainstream archaeology over the succeeding 11 years. After discovering 7291, however, his behavior became erratic enough to justify his firing from the Belarusian Academy of Sciences, as he did not possess tenure. His behavior included frequent unannounced sabbaticals, redacting citations from his academic work, refusing to reveal sources for peer review, accusing 17 colleagues of attempted plagiarism, theft of research materials from other academics, and theft of artifacts from the Belarusian State Museum, several of which were identified as anomalous in origin. Salavi was detained at Area 06 for interrogation, and due to a passing professional familiarity, Dr. Neller of the Foundation Department of Archaeology was selected to conduct Salavi's intake interview. In the interview, Salavi seems agitated and will not make eye contact, periodically smiling twitchily or nodding to himself as if in sudden understanding. Neller tells him that it's good to see him, as they last met at the Polotsk conference in 2012, if he remembers. Salovey says that of course he remembers him, and it all makes sense now. That's when it all started, the theft, and it won't stop him, and they can't stop them. They're crawling towards us from the past, inch by precious inch. Neller responds that he's gotten rather far ahead of his script and asks who exactly are the ones that are crawling towards us from the past. Salovey says that he knows damn well who. The Daevites. We're given a brief profile on the Daevite Empire, a militaristic, imperialistic theocracy that occupied a wide area of south-central Siberia and neighboring territories until its destruction in the 13th century. The Daevites were known for their employment of thaumaturgy, ritualism, slavery, human sacrifice, cannibalism, and ontokinetics. Daevite archaeological sites continued to be discovered well beyond the Empire's original bounds, representing attempted conquests or the waxing and waning of political power. Such sites are almost universally anomalous in nature and prejudicial to human life. The most problematic artifact of the Daevites is a 20th century historical monograph describing their socio-political history, SCP-140, A Chronicle of the Devas. When exposed to a sufficient quantity of ink or any effective ink substitute, the monograph will amend itself to retroactively continue the story of the Empire beyond its supposed destruction. These changes will be written into baseline reality, and the Empire's timeline will expand closer to the present day. This existential threat makes prompt analysis of any and all Daevite sites and artifacts discovered by the Foundation a paramount priority. Neller asks how exactly he knows about the Daevites, causing Salovey to laugh and say that the Foundation stole his memories, but he got them back. He found them in the dark, found himself, found his purpose. He should thank them for that much, as the missing time, files, and the blank hole they carved out of his life gave him a drive he's never known before. He remembers Neller from that conference, lean and hungry, and says that he always had that drive, but didn't have anything to show for it. Salovey never had anything to show either, but it never mattered to him. He stumbled into archaeology like a drunk to an open bar, and wanted a job where he could spend time outdoors and have other people do the heavy lifting. It never mattered to him before Minsk, before the Foundation made it matter, but that was nothing compared to what he found deep down in the earth. He says that he keeps wanting to tell Neller, as it's a devilish secret to keep, wriggling against the back of his brain, but it's only meant for him. Until it belongs to everyone. Neller tells him that he's going in circles, but Salovey responds that he's leading him in circles, and Neller's following, like he always has. He's not going to get anywhere by nipping at Salovey's boot heels, and won't make his name by discrediting his. Neller stands and says that they'll speak again after he's examined his work, but Salovey tells him that he won't find it, and if he does, he won't understand it. It's in a code that he'll never break, not in a Deva's age, and he tells Neller to trust him on this one thing, that he wouldn't want to understand it. An MTF was sent into Salovey's last known residence in the city of Pinsk, locating a cache of research materials after a brief search, and several minor injuries sustained via interaction with crude household traps. The files were encrypted, with Reza cryptographers cracking each cipher in short order, revealing the location of Salovey's most recent and undeclared archaeological worksite. A brief drone reconnaissance was performed, mapping the main tomb chambers, but stopped short of the rear tunnel network, with the anomaly being classified SCP-7291. Repeated requests to the Department of Containment by Dr. Neller resulted in his nomination as project lead, at which point he quickly assembled a team and arranged their transportation to the Pinsk marshes. The team consists of Neller, three members from the Department of History, two from the Department of Tactical Theology, 3 from the Engineering and Technical Services Department, 1 from the Logistics Department, 1 from the Department of Geophysics, 1 from the Medical Department, and 5 MTF members. Neller's application for a registered thaumaturge to join the team was rejected by Overwatch Command due to the potentially disastrous risk posed by spiritual possession. Neller rejected the deployment of Scranton reality anchors, citing irreparable damage done to similar archaeological sites by the use of such equipment. A temporary base camp was established at the mouth of the cave leading to the tomb entrance, where the team were outfitted with lapel cameras and radio transmitters. A second drone survey was then carried out, confirming the results of the first, and the entire group began their descent into the tomb. The tunnel slopes down steeply and turns at sharp angles very frequently, though there is sufficient headroom and space for 3 to walk abreast. The air is filled with particles of dust, and Technician DaCosta asks if they're sure if this is completely safe, to which the MTF captain says, of course not. The engineering chief says that they won't get any cave-ins, which DaCosta says he's not worried about, at which point he sneezes, and asks if they shouldn't be wearing masks. One of the medical doctors tells him that there is no threat of contagion, as the place is completely sterile, which is a problem of its own, since this is in the middle of a marsh. The MTF captain says that they're the advance party, and they need to get this threat squared away, but DaCosta remarks that it doesn't seem prudent to risk this many experts in an advance party. Neller counters that when you don't send the experts, that's when it becomes dangerous. This site is too precious and too potentially sensitive to risk anyone blundering around down there uninformed. Should anything happen, they need folks on hand who know precisely how to deal with it. This prompts one of the history professors to comment that Neller has assembled a fine collection of experts in esoterica and no other archaeologist besides himself. Neller says that Dr. Plesko will be taking the lead here, as Davite Empire researchers are almost always generalists. DaCosta asks why, and Plesko responds that there's no line between belief and practice for the Davites. Their architecture, their artifacts, their rituals, their politics, their magic, it's all connected. You can't understand any of it unless you think holistically, and she's trained for decades for an opportunity like this. DaCosta asks if they're pretty sure this place is Davite then, to which Neller says that Salavi seemed certain, and the chief engineer says that the tunnel composition fits the profile roughly. Plesko says that it's certainly not the Empire's best work, and would say that it was put together in great haste. In contrast, the chief engineer notes that stone imported from India and bedrock tunneling has never been described as hasty before. Plesko responds that she's speaking of the standards of a technologically advanced people for their ever-advancing day. They were experts at bedrock tunneling, and were fond of deep places. The team reaches the end of the descent and are standing in the forecourt. It is a large, roughly cubical cave room only decorated at the southern end, where an ornate entrance portal has been carved. Neller says that that's all conjecture, as the tomb could have easily been constructed by locals, using practices learned from the Devas, but Plesko doesn't think that's likely. The Devas didn't teach their techniques, and they didn't encourage literacy amongst their slaves. They were not great disseminators of information, though they did like to leave messages. She hesitates, though, and says that the matter is closed now, indicating an inscription above the doorway. This inscription wasn't on the original feed from the drone footage, and Booth, from the history department, says that it looks like ancient Davite lettering to his half-trained eye. Plesko confirms that it is ancient Davite, but when she asks if she should translate it, the other history professors say absolutely not. DaCosta asks why it wouldn't be safe, and Neller tells him that the Davites weren't above encoding curses into their carvings. Plesko says that they weren't above much of anything, but she believes this to be safe, as it's so far from the heart of the Empire, and so long ago. If a curse was laid, it will have long since lost its potency. Neller says that if the Orichalcos core on the drone didn't crack, there's likely no strong thaumaturgy around the entrance. Plesko proceeds to translate the inscription, which reads, "An omen of warning for those who would steal the secrets sequestered behind the Black Seal. Naught here will you find but what others have lost. Your vessels be emptied, and sanguine the cost." The MTF captain says that that's pretty standard spooky go-away tomb stuff, but Professor Booth is disturbed by the fact that Plesko could idiomatically translate ancient Davite on the fly, and more disturbed that her translation rhymes in English. Plesko says that it does rhyme in Davite as well, to which Booth says that that's much worse. Neller says that it's an odd sign, but the exploration does need to progress. The MTF will remain on high alert, but they should proceed. The two members of the Tactical Theology Department say that the import of the engraving is clear. They won't like the revelations they find, and the implication of mortal peril is quite clear. There's also the suggestion that this was sealed up to protect thieves from what's inside, rather than deter them from stealing it. One of the history professors says that there's nothing in Belarusian folklore about a black seal, while Plesko can think of half a dozen black seals in Davik culture. Booth notes that an actual black seal is notably absent from the door, but Plesko says that that's not surprising. They know that Salovey was obsessed, so of course he broke the seal and plunged forward. Neller says that judging by his manner, he's certain that Salovey was affected by a curse of some variety, possibly from breaking the seal. Plesko remarks that the vessels from the inscription is presumably a metaphor of their bodies, which will be emptied. The MTF captain takes that to mean that they'll puke their guts out, but Booth says that she's not thinking Davite enough. More likely, someone else will pull their guts out. They're interrupted as one of the MTF agents calls out to a cat nearby, sitting on its haunches beneath the doorframe and staring at the team. The rest of the MTF raises their weapons, with the captain asking if it's a Davite cat monster. Plesko responds that they had tree monsters and dirt monsters, but definitely not cat monsters. The Davites considered cats anathema and boiled them alive, disposing of their bodies in quarries by the hundreds. The captain takes aim at the cat, but it sneezes, surprising her and making her shot go wide. The cat disappears into the tomb again. Neller supposes that that was Salovey's cat, as he apparently chased it into the tunnels after he became convinced that it was spying on him for the Davites. In any event, he thinks that they can move on, and they'll make camp in either the outer or inner chamber, depending on conditions. He tells the rest of the group to keep an eye out for any more tomb monsters, and the chief engineer sneezes. A secondary team from the Engineering and Technical Services Department transported the team's equipment and a series of modular partitions into the outer chamber. They were then recalled and extracted for quarantine off-site in order to limit the number of potential exposures to the tomb. The remainder of the first day was occupied by the construction of the new interior base camp, including a partitioned, hermetically sealable clean room for sensitive communications and computing equipment, including remote monitors for each team member's lapel cameras. A partitioned, hermetically sealable medical chamber, an open barracks and common room, and partitioned washroom facilities with deep-drilled access to the water table were also set up. While the technicians and the engineering chief installed and tested their equipment, the academics combed the five main chambers for artifacts. They managed to find three sharp daggers, one large cleaver, two spears, and numerous sundry pieces of decorative art. Plesko identified each artifact as Davite in origin, but Neller was dissatisfied, calling the collection nothing but bog-standard grave goods. This prompted a brief altercation with one of the technicians when he chose to make light of this word choice given the site's geographical surroundings. The absence of any artifacts or remains in the open sarcophagus was confirmed, with the consensus being that Salovey had likely removed anything of value. Neller expressed the opinion that nothing of substance could be learned from the site without examining its closed counterpart, which brought about several hours of fierce debate. The next morning, the engineering chief performed an X-ray scan of the closed sarcophagus, determining it to be either empty or impervious to X-rays. The two tactical theology doctors performed a series of tests on both sarcophagi, finding their signatures identically consistent with unmodified baseline reality. Neller then instructed one of the technicians, Rizwana, to begin installation and testing of his Razor equipment, complex stress equalization lifting devices, on both sarcophagi. The device on the open sarcophagus was used to generate training data for the device for the other. Once Rizwana was confident that the second lid could be raised without incident, Neller gave the order to make an attempt. Rizwana remotely operated the device from the clean room, while the others all watched from the outer chamber cam through monitors. One of the tactical theology doctors remarks that they're still moving too quickly, and it's unseemly to rush headlong into blasphemy. Plesko says that the longer they stay here, the more likely they'll start feeling adverse effects. They need more data as quickly as possible to form the basis of a situational assessment. Professor Booth remarks that he'd like to stress the value of humility whilst engaged in the act of grave robbing, and asks his fellow professor to say a few ritual words, to which he states, "Don't break it," causing the group to laugh. Rizwana reports that all of the systems are green and good to go, so Neller tells him to have at it. As he starts, however, he makes a loud exclamation, and then says that he needs to wash his hands. Neller tells him that he can't wash his hands without cycling the airlock and coming outside, and they don't have the time, prompting his fellow technician to remark that he just sneezed in the clean room. A couple of the group members swear, with one of the tactical theologians trying to tell them to refrain from mentioning any deities, but Rizwana says that he really does need to wash his hands. Neller, however, is losing his patience, and asks if he sneezed into his hands so much that they're slick with snot and he can't get a grip on the controls, or if he sneezed all over his monitor, utterly coating it so that he can't see his readouts, or if he sneezed directly onto an exposed length of electrical cable. Because unless he is materially inhibited from performing his duties as of this moment, he is asking him to confirm that his systems remain unaffected by this nasal outburst and lift that lid. After a brief pause, Rizwana says that all systems are a go, and he'll proceed. One of the history professors asks why he wanted to wash his hands, but Rizwana and Neller just say to move on. The device activates, forming a protective shell around the lid, and Neller tells him to lift the lid. There is no obvious exchange of gases as it lifts, and Rizwana notes how much stress fracturing there is. The entire thing must be spiderwebbed with cracks and hollows inside, which really ought to have turned up on the X-ray. As the chief engineer remarks that he triple-checked that X-ray, Rizwana sneezes again and jerks the controls hard to one side. The support rods on the device flex abruptly in obvious response to the input, and the lid shifts. One corner dips into the hollow. There's a series of loud cracking sounds, and the entire slab of stone breaks into multiple large fragments which tumble into the sarcophagus with a crash. This is followed by a silence from the group, before one of the history professors sneezes. One of the tactical theologians glances at Neller, who's turning red and shaking, before telling both of them, Gesundheit. Afterwards, a few of the doctors checked the anti-thaumic cellophane seal around the device's cable going into the sarcophagus room, while Neller called an emergency meeting. Neller is pacing back and forth in front of the group, and asks Rizwana if he is allergic to swamps, or dust, or perhaps the absence of dust in that perfect little working environment that they built at great expense for him. Perhaps it is the spirit of scientific inquiry that he's allergic to, or the grand collaborative project of acquiring knowledge on the contours of their ever-advancing past. Rizwana, however, says that he should have let him wash his hands, and one of the history professors chimes in to say that he might be of assistance. Every culture has its own unique superstitions regarding the sneeze, and he assumes that Rizwana is of the Hindu faith, so it's reasonable to assume that he was struck in the heat of the moment with a memory of the injunction against inaugurating any task of importance immediately subsequent to the act of sneezing. In India, the custom is to wash one's hands after sneezing, and if one does not, ill fortune is sure to follow. Neller swears and yells, stating that he checked every resume very closely before selecting the members of this team, and if the word imbecile had appeared anywhere on Rizwana's, he's certain he would have noticed it. Rizwana replies that he doesn't believe it, but in tense moments, you like to be sure. Neller says that he let himself get distracted by a fantasy, and he destroyed a priceless piece of ancient archaeology. The other doctors return, reporting that there's no akiva or thaumic emissions from the coffin whatsoever. They don't think that there was anything supernatural to disturb in there, and it could have been empty like the other. The sheets remain clean, so far as they can tell, with no discoloration and normal readings. They're also not seeing any new pathogens either, although they'd expect to see something if there were ever a burial there. They won't know for sure without shifting the rocks, though. Plesko remarks that that has D-class written all over it, prompting one of the theologians to say that of course she would want to introduce slaves into a Davite environment, although she apologizes afterwards and rubs her temples. The chief engineer says that he's also unenthused at the prospect of shifting cursed rocks, and the theologian says that she's just really concerned about the theological implications here. They might not be in any physical danger. They might not be able to measure any new threat here, but this place was definitely sacred to someone at some point. It is a tomb, and it's been consecrated, although they don't know who it's consecrated to, but they'd be very surprised if it's anything that likes having its sarcophagi smashed about. Rizwana says that they're all acting like he did this on purpose, and the member of the logistics department says that the evidence is strongly against him being able to do anything on purpose. One of the theologians tells him to lay off, prompting him to call him a God-botherer, and says that he's sick of this qualitative nonsense. They've done their measurements and checked the metrics, and nothing's wrong. The theologian counters that he can't yet provide a scientific measure for deific offense after accidental sacrilege. DaCosta chimes in to say that the door is still open, so they should just leave and dynamite the place. The chief engineer, however, is not keen on being the fulcrum of an act of historical vandalism, and votes against using them. Neller, however, says that as the man with the letters patent from Overwatch Command, he reminds them that none of them have votes. He's going to radio Overwatch for instructions, and he will inquire about D-class requisition. The quartermaster says that that seems like his department, but Neller says he wants something done here correctly for a change, and tells him to triple-check his stocks. He wants the rest of the team to keep looking for finds or analyzing architecture, and no one is to return to the surface until he says so. He definitely doesn't want some civilian spotting them and scuppering the entire dig. The MTF captain tries to argue that the upstairs base camp is well concealed, but Neller tells her to shut up and do as he says. After a brief silence, he says that this is still the finest para-archaeological site in Belarus, and he'll be thrice goddamned if they leave it empty-handed. Later, Neller subsequently reported to the team that Overwatch Command had instructed them to remain at the site for the time being, and to follow his orders to the letter, meaning to continue searching and monitoring the accessible portions of the tomb, awaiting the arrival of D-class personnel. Three team members reported difficulty falling asleep that night, so the medic gave them sleeping aids. At 1:32 in the morning, while the majority of the team slept in the outer chamber, the entire tomb was rocked by a violent explosion which deposited dust and small stones on every exposed surface. The clean and medical rooms were unaffected, as their partition walls shored up the cave ceiling, but significant equipment damage was suffered across the remainder of the camp. No injuries were reported, though the dust content in the air increased significantly. The captain of the MTF investigated the source of the explosion, finding the forecourt now filled with an insurmountable wall of rubble, from which the communications cable to the surface camp emerged, and which was stained with blasting powder and residue. The team gathered for a meeting, with a technician reporting that there's no signal back to the surface, and the chief engineer reporting that he believes that there's enough space between the stones for oxygen to get through. Additionally, while examining the rooms, he found some thin shafts cut diagonally into the walls that should function as air holes, so they should be fine, assuming they don't stay down here indefinitely. The quartermaster says that there's no way they can stay indefinitely regardless due to their supplies, although they're good for a while. The cat from before then appears, regarding the team evenly, and the captain moves to take care of it, but Neller tells her not to burn off air with unnecessary gunplay. The captain says that they do have more dangerous things to hunt anyways, as someone used blasting powder to bring down the entranceway, likely someone in this camp. The chief engineer heads over to the cat and begins petting it, as it purrs. Professor Booth wonders why someone would seal them in, with one of the theologians suggesting that maybe someone here doesn't want to walk away. The cat suddenly sneezes, causing the chief engineer to recoil in surprise. The other history professor shouts for them to seize the engineer, but no one moves, so he explains that the chief is the demolitions expert, and no one else knows the first thing about blasting. He's the only one here who could take down a wall without bringing down the whole cave. The captain admits that she doesn't recall seeing the chief in his bunk last night. The engineer responds that he was there, however, and asks what reason he would have for blowing up their only way out of here. The history professor says that he doesn't think it had anything at all to do with reason, as he's beyond reason now. It's about the sneezing, as first Rizwana sneezed and then immediately fouled up a foul-proof system. He wagers that Rizwana's second sneeze was just for show, and he purposefully broke the seal. Then the chief sneezed, and a few hours later causes a worse disaster of his very own. Rizwana defends himself by saying that it's dusty as hell down here, and even the cat is sneezing. The professor, however, says that, like he said before, every culture has their own unique take on the sneeze. The cult of the mystic Archeom of Sluck from the Principality of Poltosk believes that a sneeze in a profane place signifies possession by the unhappy ancestral dead. Professor Booth counters that they also believe that cat urine is a potent sedative and asks him if he's in desperate need of another tranquilizer, as they have a cat close at hand. The chief engineer, however, mentions that his grandmother always told him that when you sneeze, demons can get inside, and the Davites were demon worshippers. Dr. Plesko steps in to say that that's a gross mischaracterization, sparking another argument between her and one of the theologians. The captain of the MTF asks which one she should shoot first, to which the history professor says to shoot the chief, as he's lost, along with Rizwana. He asks Plesko what the inscription had said, recalling the words, "Not here will you find but what others have lost. Your vessels be emptied, and sanguine the cost." He continues, saying that this place is filled with the souls of lost Davic ancestors, all of them searching desperately for purchase. They're free real estate now, because they lost their souls when they broke that sarcophagus. The sneezes are the smoking gun. One of the theologians says that it takes an awful lot to offend her sense of blasphemy, but he's finally managed it. Her soul is right where it's supposed to be, and so is his. The professor is adamant, however, saying that it's all falling in place now, and that's why he couldn't sleep. He's lost, and so is the chief, and Rizwana, who is slowly edging away from the group. Booth tries to calm him down, telling him that his argument has no internal logic. Either he's tired because he's lost his soul, or they can pick up Daveite souls by sneezing. He can't have it both ways. The professor admits that maybe the sneezes have nothing to do with it, and maybe the old sarcophagus took Rizwana's soul when he was tinkering with it, and then he broke the other sarcophagus to take care of the rest of them. At this point, Rizwana starts running out of the room, closing and locking the door behind him as the captain raises her firearm. While they're distracted, the chief grabs one of the agent's sidearms and elbows him in the stomach. He tries to tell everyone to stay away from him, but is tackled by the same agent. Two gunshots then occur in quick succession, and the chief runs, weeping, from the room. The agent falls to the floor, and the medic rushes to his side, as he is already bleeding profusely. The sound of ripping plastic is audible in the far distance, along with the chief's panicked scream, as he yells the word, "Demons." Despite the medic's best efforts, the agent died within minutes. The team assessed the ruined thaumic cellophane, determining that there was no reason to continue to sequester the team in the outer chamber. Captain Cassidy established an emergency security cordon at the entrance to the rear tunnels with her remaining agents, while Rizwana refused to open the cleanroom door. He could be seen in the window, emphatically shaking his head, and would not open the intercom despite explicit written instructions and particularly explicit visual threats from Cassidy. DaCosta resumed drone mapping the interior tunnels, attempting to locate both an alternate exit and the chief. At midnight, Professor Booth called for another team meeting, all of whom gather except for one agent, DaCosta, and Rizwana. Cassidy says that they need an action plan, and asks why Booth called this meeting, wondering what's up with Neller. Neller, however, doesn't say anything, as Booth says to leave him be for the moment. The group bickers for a moment before Booth says that the purpose of this meeting is to develop a working framework to explain what's happening to them. Cassidy offers the theory of low oxygen, but the medic shoots it down, saying that they're still breathing deep and the CO2 levels haven't changed. The chief was probably right about those air vents, and they're damn lucky that they weren't damaged by the explosion. Cassidy, however, says that it's more like he knew that they wouldn't be damaged when he caused the explosion. One of the theologians says that they don't know it was him, but the other theologian says that he just shot someone in cold blood. Plesko muses that rambling about demons and running in terror constitute hot blood, she would think. To which the female theologian says that she's the resident hot blood expert. Booth says that this is a suitable segue to their first thorny dilemma, which is the question of whether the chief was possessed by a demon via involuntary nasal spasm. The quartermaster assumes that there's some sort of explanation buried somewhere behind all of this preface, to which Booth asks Plesko what the relationship between the Daveite Empire and this region of Belarus is. Plesko explains that they were here for a period not exceeding 1 year, in the 12th century. They withdrew their armies after significant civil unrest in the home provinces, one of the many events that killed them off entirely, before SCP-140 pushed the timeline forward again. The prevailing theory for why they gave up Belarus is economic, too costly to remain for too little material gain. Well beyond the periphery of the Empire, no resources they didn't already have in abundance. Not even enough slaves or sacrificial subjects to whet their appetites. So they cut their losses and left without leaving much trace on the landscape, as all they've ever seen are scattered camps in major population centers. Booth, however, believes that the Daveites did not retreat from anything ever, as theirs was a history of advance. He doesn't believe that they would have abandoned this place unless the very earth were salted and uninhabitable. Perhaps this was the epicenter of some disaster which forced their collective hand. Perhaps they tried to dig a tomb and dug something up instead. Or maybe they tried to dig a tomb and dedicate it to some deity, but found it exceeding specifications. Or more frightful still, Perhaps a local power interrupted their consecration and claimed the space for its own. No land on Earth is devoid entirely of gods. Plesko says the theory is possible, and perhaps they added that inscription after the disaster as set dressing, trying to frame this place as a tomb with a protective curse on it to lure in tomb robbers and force them to deal with whatever horrors the Daevites woke up. She then laughs and says that what if they cursed this place intentionally, labeled it misleadingly, and left it as a landmine for their ungrateful unsubjects to tread on when they'd gone. They could have seeded dozens of these things throughout the marshes, and they've only found the first so far. Which would mean that this isn't a tomb, but a trap, and they've got their foot stuck in it. Neller finally speaks up, saying that it's thanks to him. And while the quartermaster tries to tell him that nobody could have predicted this, Neller admits to dynamiting the entrance. He couldn't walk away with nothing, not again. He's been with the Department of Archaeology for 34 years, and has never so much as been shortlisted for a leadership position. He's written a dozen monographs that nobody reads, supervised 24 doctors who went on to exceed him at half his age, managed countless dig sites that never meant anything to anyone, and he's never seen anything as perfect as this place. It has all the signs, as Salovey found something in the first sarcophagus, and he was meant to find something in the other. There were secrets, and some of them are still there, waiting for them. The poisoned soil is rich with promise, and this was the site to make his career. This was going to be his legacy. Cassidy interrupts him, however, and asks him if he sneezed since he's been down here, pulling out her sidearm and pointing it at him. He says no, not once, and you can check his camera feed if she'd like. The technician says that they can't, as the feeds go into the clean room, and they don't go there anymore. But Rizwana activates the intercom and says that he's taking a look. Cassidy yells at him to open the door, but he replies that no souls are allowed in the clean room, just empty vessels. The quartermaster brings the discussion back to Neller, telling him that he's killed all of them. He's spent 20 years on Neller's projects, the best years of his life, and this is what it gets him. Everyone here wants to know what's going on with this place, and no one would have just turned and walked away, but Neller didn't even ask if they wanted to stay. Neller replies that he heard him talking about dynamiting the place, as he lost faith in the work, so Neller lost faith in him. Cassidy interrupts the argument by saying that she's clearing out one of the chief's closets and putting him in it. Professor Booth says that if Neller performed his act of method faith without the benefit of an ancient curse, they are faced with the possibility that the chief's moment of weakness was an isolated outburst. Cassidy balks at his usage of the phrase moment of weakness, but says that as of this moment, she's in command of the dig site. They're all going to sit tight, stay in the camp, and wait for Harma to show up with the D-class. They'll see the entrance is compromised, and dig them out. Neller, however, says that they won't, and nobody's coming. He told Overwatch to quarantine the area and not to come down until either they receive an all clear or 30 days have passed, which is the extent of their rations. He apologizes, but the room bursts into activity, and the quartermaster swears and shoves Neller. Cassidy moves to the weapons locker and grabs a pump-action shotgun, telling the others that she's trained in crowd control. Neller stands and says that it doesn't matter who did what, it matters why. They all want the same thing right now, to find out what's going on in this tomb, how it works, and how they can protect themselves from it. Learning the secrets and surviving the next 4 weeks are the same thing. Cassidy interrupts him by pumping the shotgun, as Booth tries to turn the conversation back to the original purpose of this meeting. He, however, is interrupted by Neller suddenly sneezing, prompting an agent to shout for Cassidy to shoot him. Neller suddenly cries out in pain and shock, clutching at his forehead before toppling backward, striking his head on the edge of the bench with a loud cracking sound. There is blood and hair left on the bench as he strikes the stone floor, and the second cracking sound is significantly softer and wetter. Cassidy looks down at the shotgun in shock as she has not fired it. Neller weakly asks for someone to say Gesundheit, but as the medic rushes over to him, he passes. Cassidy shouts at the quartermaster that he gave him a heart attack, to which the quartermaster counters that she's the one with the shotgun. The medic, however, says that it wasn't a heart attack, as he reached for his head, and she thinks that he burst an aneurysm. The theologians point out that it occurred right after he sneezed, to which Booth says that this is just further evidence. Neller was not a young man, and so if whatever malign influence pervades this place was trying to enter into him at his moment of weakness, it may have been too much for his system, and shocked him to death. Cassidy turns to the medic, who asks if she wants her to perform a post-mortem demonic possession rejection test. The theologians, however, say that they do actually have something like that at Tactical Theology, but they didn't bring it along. The agent and DaCosta come back to the camp, asking what's going on, as they heard shouting, but the agent suddenly sneezes twice in rapid succession. After a brief moment of silence, Cassidy strikes the agent with the butt of her weapon, and catches him as he falls unconscious. The agent, Panosian, was sequestered in the medical room for monitoring, with the doctor inducing a medical coma. She also administered sleeping aids to the majority of the team to allow them to sleep through the night. Rizwana reported that Neller's lapel camera footage showed no evidence of him having sneezed prior to that night's meeting, and he's now reviewing all of the team's footage. The corpses of the agent that the chief shot and Neller were removed to one of the dead-end tunnels beyond the inner burial chamber. During the process, DaCosta disappeared along with the control mechanisms for his drone. Cassidy ordered that all future ventures into the tunnels utilize the buddy system to prevent further disappearances. The other history professor, Huff, however, disregarded this admonishment, taking to wandering the tunnels alone, returning as the mood took him. The team gathers for another meeting, with Booth saying that the concept of the humble sneeze as a trigger for calamity is not so outrageous as it might first appear. It's possible that the superstitions appertaining thereto were derived from this place, or places like it, outposts of Davic nasal warfare. The medic, however, says that that isn't particularly useful information. It's much more valuable to know why they sneeze, and how to stop it, than it is to waste their precious air floating theories they can't prove. Booth says that the medic doesn't seem to value Huff's folklore very much, but he just shrugs and looks away. The medic says that sneezing is a reflex action, a stimulus response. It's involuntary, but there are ways to both cause and prevent it to a degree. You should avoid dramatic changes in both temperature and light level, and sudden flashes can certainly cause them. An agent brings up the question again on if they should be wearing masks, but the medic says that it doesn't seem that airborne particulates are causing the sneezes. Plus, it's already difficult to breathe down there, and masks might prevent them from noticing when someone does sneeze. As for prevention, if you feel one coming on, use your tongue to tickle the roof of your mouth. Under normal circumstances, she'd tell you not to suppress a sneeze, as that can cause serious damage. But if worse comes to worst, it might be worthwhile to try simply plugging your nose. Booth says that if the operative effect is something emerging from or entering the nasal passages, that might be true. But what about the expulsion of breath? It has to come out eventually, one way or another, and where the sneeze is an indicator that something awry has occurred, is it very helpful to prevent the outward sign? Huff finally speaks, wondering if that's why Booth keeps putting his handkerchief over his face, so they can't tell if he's just sneezed or not. There's a silence, and Plesko says that he's got a point, and she has her eye on him. Exploration of the tunnels continued in earnest as the need to discover an exit became more urgent. The female theologian, Fidelia, and Cassidy are moving along a dark stretch of tunnel together, with Cassidy placing small, round work lights on the wall as they progress. Fidelia mentions that the idea that your heart stops when you sneeze dates back to the Renaissance, so when we say God bless you, we're actually speaking straight to the heart. Cassidy bluntly responds that she didn't request this information, but Fidelia continues, saying that some people say it really started during the Black Death, but she's not so sure. She's seen equally good arguments for people becoming less and more religious during that period as a result of trauma, and the cited sources are spotty at best. For a time, the standard protocol was to perform the sign of the cross whenever you sneezed, an edict of Pope Gregory. Cassidy calls out her name, and she apologizes, saying that Booth's last meeting really got her thinking, and they need to work this through. She wonders at a man as steeped in academic rigor as Kneller succumbing so completely to superstition. He used his last moments on Earth to complain that nobody wished him good health, as that's what Gesundheit means in German. It's not particularly religious, just magical thinking, but Cassidy cuts in to say that religion is magical thinking. After a silence, Cassidy says that when she comes up with the retort, do them both a favor and just imagine her reaction. Meanwhile, the male theologian, Maximo, and agent Valenti are exploring an exceptionally dusty tunnel, with Valenti forced to brush dust off the walls before affixing his work lights. Maximo says that he still worries that there might be some sort of local trigger for these phenomena that they don't know about, and wishes that he could pick Huff's brain. Valenti says that he saw Huff in one of these tunnels earlier today, staring at a blank wall. He asked him why he didn't at least go stare at something interesting, to which he said, "Nothing is interesting." Maximo explains that he's absolutely convinced that he has no soul now, to which Valenti says that so is he, but for different reasons. Maximo asks if he doesn't believe in them, which he doesn't, and he says that that's sensible. Valenti is surprised, since Maximo is a pastor, but Maximo wonders who keeps telling people that they're pastors. He tells him not to give up on Huff, or anybody, because if they keep muddling around, in their own ways, they're bound to stumble over a solution before too long. Valenti still likes to think that they'll make it out of this all right, because, after all, the cat sneezed. It didn't come up at the meeting, and he felt silly bringing it up, but cats sneezing is good luck. Dr. Plesko is accompanying Agent Russell on the same task, remarking on how breathtaking a cavern they're looking at is. It's completely filled with fossilized plant matter, and a massive tangle of roots and gnarled trunks stretches from the floor to the distant ceiling, all of it coated with a thick layer of dust. Russell asks what's so breathtaking, and as Plesko starts to explain, she pinches her nose and comments on how dusty it is in here. She says that it's the remains of a small army of tree golems, the hands that worked these tunnels. They weren't human at all, and she hopes that they get out of this so she can get specimens back to the site with proper lighting. Russell removes a work light and says that they can probably improve the lighting here a little bit. Before Plesko can call out and stop her, Russell activates the work light on the wall, illuminating the curtain of dust falling between them. The camera view is obscured, and a loud sound is heard, followed by silence. Plesko tells Russell to wait, but is interrupted by the sounds of struggle and muffled screams, followed by a gunshot and silence. Plesko returns to camp with a dislocated arm and defensive wounds on her exposed skin. She states that Russell had sneezed, then immediately attempted to strangle her, and she had been forced to engage in violence to protect herself. She eventually got a hold of Russell's firearm and discharged it, but she's unsure if Russell survived, as she immediately fled as soon as the shot was fired. Plesko's lapel camera had been damaged during the struggle, and was now non-functional. Technician Gill was sent to recover the cameras on Neller and the dead agent's corpses, but they were found to be missing. The medic reported that Panosian's camera had apparently been stolen as well, and Cassidy requested that Rizwana emerge from the clean room to hand over his camera, but he declined to respond. Cassidy then demanded that the entire team hand in their lapel cameras, to be dispensed only when parties engaged in tunnel exploration. A hurried vote rejected this measure, and despite threats from Cassidy, it seemed that the team would continue as they have been. Plesko, however, was forbidden to enter the tunnels without accompaniment by at least one member with a functioning camera, which she eagerly agreed to, fearful of both the chief and Russell. Cassidy further mandated that all cameras be kept in perfect working order and not be tampered with in any way, insinuating that any mechanical failure would result in the immediate execution of its bearer. On a routine check of their finds cabinet, the quartermaster discovered that the Davite cleaver and one ritual dagger were missing, prompting another team meeting on the afternoon of the fourth day. The medic reports that there are supplies missing from her kit and from her stores, specifically her sleeping aids and the excitants she keeps around for reversing the effect in emergencies. All of them. She gestures over to Agent Panosian, the agent who sneezed and was knocked out, saying that she won't be able to keep him out for much longer, so she put him out in the open where they can all keep an eye on him. She's worried, though, as to what the thief could be planning, when Fidelia comes in and says that she can't find her husband, Maximo. Cassidy asks Rizwana, who's still in the clean room, where Maximo is based on his camera feed, which seems to be in their outhouse. After knocking on the door and getting no response, she opens the door, finding the camera glued to the wall. Cassidy asks Rizwana how he failed to notice this happening, to which he replies that he's got all he can manage to monitor all of them for sneezing while they're strolling the sneeze factory floor. Professor Booth wonders if it's possible if he performed a Captain Oates, referencing an Antarctic explorer who walked out into a blizzard to die to relieve his fellow explorers of the burden of caring for him. As Fidelia is saying absolutely not, the medic suddenly sneezes and everyone freezes. She dives for the medical partition, yells at everyone to stay back, and seals the door behind her. Cassidy raises her keycard to go in, but Booth stops her, saying that she's a medical professional and must think that there's a physiological explanation for all of this. Cassidy just thinks that she's blockading herself in with all the medical supplies. And after a pause, the medic announces that she's opened and upturned everything that they have stockpiled, as it was contaminated and would only have lured them in. Cassidy asks what it was contaminated with, but she's met with only silence, until the medic says that when they're rescued, tell them to come in with a full hazmat team. Another sneeze is then heard from the group, and they turn to glance at one another, no one sure of who sneezed. Cassidy tells the culprit to fess up, but when no one responds, she pumps her shotgun. Technician Gill then admits that it was him, and says that he's just going outside, and he may be some time. He then heads for the tunnels in silence, and does not look back. The six remaining team members at this point continue to explore the tunnels, with Professor Huff now spending almost all of his time wandering, even failing to return to camp for lights out on the fifth day. Cassidy restrained Agent Panosian, and requested that Rizwana inform her should the agent awaken while the camp was unattended. Though the tunnels continued to stretch out beneath the marsh with no sign of an exit, Booth and Valenti did make one discovery during an outing on the sixth day. Booth is discussing how he hasn't been able to think of a single agenda besides chaos, which could explain all of the actions undertaken by those possessed. They aren't acting towards any concerted goal, and have all been affected differently by whatever this effect may be. Valenti suggests that maybe ancestral spirits are like academics and don't get along. Booth laughs and says that he hadn't considered the unfairness of stereotyping the ancestors, as that's more of an archaeology thing. Suddenly, Valenti stops and smells something. They turn the next bend in the tunnel cautiously, finding a vivisected corpse. It's naked, the clothing left in a ragged and bloody pile, and the skin is flayed from head to toe around a central cavity in the chest. Organs and veins are arranged on the stone floor in unfamiliar patterns suggestive of lettering, with the spaces between carefully linked by streaks of blackened blood. Valenti immediately vomits, and Booth presses his handkerchief into his face. Then the Davite cleaver that was missing appears on Booth's camera feed, slicing out of the darkness. It passes over Valenti's head, but strikes Booth a glancing blow, causing him to grunt in pain and stumble. The cleaver finishes arcing into a pre-existing crack in the wall, dislodging a chunk of stone and precipitating a low rumble in the cave roof. Booth slips, presumably on the viscera, and falls as the ceiling collapses. All six team members were absent from the camp at this time, investigating the tunnels in pairs. Rizwana reported the attack over the radio, though Cassidy and Fidelia had already heard the tremors and were on their way back to investigate. They found a solid rock fall, like the one blocking the entrance, where the missing pair had been exploring. They returned to camp to find that Agent Panosian was also missing. Cassidy is yelling at Rizwana for falling asleep, and although he tries to argue in his defense that he's been staying awake as much as he can, she points her shotgun at him and yells that he had one job. Plesko returns to the camp, out of breath, and asks where the quartermaster is, as they were together but got separated. She thinks that they were being chased, so Rizwana starts to check his feed as the quartermaster shows up, asking where Plesko went and why she started running. Plesko wonders how he didn't hear it, and if he was lagging behind for some reason. She asks if there would be a reason that he wouldn't be afraid of what's lurking in the tunnels. Fidelia interrupts them to mention the smell, and the team turns to face the medical partition. Cassidy says that as a new rule, she'll check the tunnels alone, and no one else leaves this camp. If she comes back and they're not here, they graduate to her shoot-on-sight list. Cassidy continued to place lights in the farther reaches of the tunnel, relaying map information back to Rizwana, who agreed to keep track of comings and goings in the outer chamber, but none were reported. The following morning, Cassidy returned from an outing and called her remaining three team members to a meeting: Fidelia, the quartermaster, and Plesko. Cassidy says that they're almost at the end, and that at least one of them is on the way out. She took a few images with her PDA last night and today, and asks if any of it looks familiar. She shows an image of the vivisected corpse discovered by Valenti and Booth, next to the fallen rocks. Plesko says that it's ritualistic, but meaningless ritual so far as she can tell. Maybe Huff could have told them different, but who knows where he's gotten to. Cassidy replies that that's pretty much what he said she'd say, and informs them that the body belongs to Agent Russell. Plesko says that she presumably either died of the injuries that she gave her and the chief hacked her dead body to pieces, or she missed her mark and the chief did the entire job himself. Fidelia says that it doesn't look much like cleaver work to her, and Cassidy agrees and says that this is cleaver work, showing a second image. This one displays a dismembered corpse, the limbs hacked apart haphazardly and thrown about the tunnel floor, which is slick with blood and organ pulp and mulched entrails. Technician DaCosta's head is staring at the camera, upside down between his left leg and right arm. Fidelia looks away in horror, and Plesko understands this to mean that there's two killers, with plenty of candidates to choose from. Fidelia remarks that Huff thinks that he's lost his soul and comes and goes as he pleases, and Valenti, Booth, Panosian, and Gil are all missing. Plesko chimes in that so is her husband, Maximo, but she tells her to shut her mouth. Cassidy says that it's not Panosian, showing an image of another vivisected corpse with the sigils in different shapes on the stone floor, and it's not Gil either, showing an image of his body with his chest cavity completely emptied of viscera and arranged on the stone floor in three separate iterations of the same sigil. Cassidy says to Plesko to tell her one more time that she doesn't recognize the significance of this, to which Plesko says that she doesn't. Cassidy guesses that it must make her feel pretty important, though, being the only person left alive in a Daevite tomb who knows anything about the Daevites. It would be great if she could get a second opinion and ask Professor Booth before playing a recording on her PDA. In it, Booth says that the corpses are nasty bits of work, and he almost thought he recognized the first one when that cleaver came singing through the air. He sounds exhausted, but Cassidy urges him to keep going. He explains that the entrails in the first image are arranged in a form meaning a harvest, which they might infer in this context to mean a human sacrifice. Cassidy shows him a second one, which he interprets to literally just mean a human sacrifice. He chuckles and says that they had many ways to talk about human sacrifices. Cassidy shows him one more, which he again interprets as a different way to mean a human sacrifice, one with specifically religious intent. He believes that their artist was possessed with the urgent need to be sure that their message has been understood. When Cassidy asks, "Understood by who?" he replies that he imagines the Daevite pantheon, as those are Daevite words. Cassidy stops the recording and points her shotgun at Plesko, telling her to lie to her. Plesko asks if this is how she wants to spend her time down here, dividing them into camps and victimizing each other. Cassidy tells her to lie more directly, as she hasn't got all day. Plesko responds that she hasn't killed anyone, and asks how cliché can she get. She's trying to frame the Daevite expert, as anyone who spends that much time studying the evil empire has just got to be already evil. All she needs to do is convince a Christian dupe and some idiot pencil pusher, and she'll have one more sane, normal human being sacrificed to her demented ritual. As they're talking, Fidelia slips past the quartermaster into the outer burial chamber. Cassidy asks if that's honestly all she's got is her defense, as she failed three times in a row to recognize letters that they all know she can read. Plesko argues that she's an academic, not an entrail scryer, but Cassidy says that she murdered Russell, cut her body up into pieces, and painted the floor with her guts to send a message to gods who've already been dead for centuries. She bets that it was Plesko who sneezed, and she turned on her so she wouldn't tell. She wonders if Russell damaged Plesko's camera in the scuffle, or if she did that as well, so she could come and go as she pleases. Rizwana chimes in to say that that's pretty rich coming from Cassidy. Fidelia quietly returns to the room, grabbing her jacket and putting it on. Rizwana says that he's looked over all the camera feeds and discovered that Cassidy turned her camera off just for a second, a few hours after they lost the chief and the agent. She was alone and turned it back on after, and it must be some sort of special cop trick that no one else knows how to do. Cassidy pumps her shotgun again and says that if Rizwana is going to pick a side, he might want to pick the side that has a scatter gun. Rizwana counters that they outnumber her, and he's behind a locked door, so he likes those odds. She definitely turned that camera off when she realized she was about to sneeze. The blip was so minuscule, he wouldn't have even thought to check if he hadn't noticed that her feed file was a few megabytes too light. This was days ago now, and they've trusted her this entire time as she's led them like sheep to the slaughter. Cassidy yells at him to shut up, as a sneeze is heard coming from the door to the inner burial chamber. Cassidy wheels around and fires the shotgun, blasting the quartermaster directly in the face and killing him instantly. The cat, which was standing behind him, rears back and hisses, before sneezing again and bolting. Cassidy stares into space for a moment, before pumping the shotgun again and blasting the locking mechanism to the clean room. Plesko says that they need to get out of here, as her and Fidelia escape out of the chamber past the quartermaster's remains. Klesko runs past the sarcophagus in the outer burial chamber, while Fidelia lags behind as a second shotgun blast is heard. A hand rises up out of the sarcophagus, and Fidelia grabs it, pulling Maximo up to a sitting position. She asks him how he feels, to which he says like somebody buried him alive, or rather, dead. Fidelia peeks into the outer chamber just in time to see a burst of blood and gore strike the inside of the clean room as the shotgun fires another time. She turns away and helps her husband out of the sarcophagus, telling him there's no time to talk. They hobble into the empty inner chamber, followed by the inner burial chamber where the collapsed sarcophagus is. The sound of Cassidy repumping the shotgun is heard from behind them. Maximo says that he feels like he missed something, to which Fidelia says a few days and a half dozen meals, but he'll cope. She used the last of the medic's excitants to wake him up, and it's probably going to hit him like a freight train in a few hours. He asks why he was down, to which she says she drugged him and buried him like the kings of old, like a deva, before laughing. He asks why, and she tells him it was because she loves him, and he can't sneeze in REM sleep. As they round a corner into the tunnels, the shotgun discharges from far behind, chipping away flakes of stone from the wall near them. They begin hurrying through the passages for approximately 5 minutes before footfalls become audible ahead of them, so they stop and listen. Maximo asks who's left, and she says Klesko, Cassidy, Huff, and maybe Booth, but who knows about anyone else. The footfalls stop, then suddenly grow louder, until Klesko rounds the nearest corner holding a pistol. She sees the two doctors and lowers her weapon. She thinks that Cassidy probably went back to get something nastier than a shotgun out of the weapons cabinet, or something from the fines cabinet, as it's amazing how sharp those daggers still are after all these years. Fidelia insinuates that Klesko was responsible for the killings, to which Klesko sighs and asks if it isn't about time that they started to trust each other. Maximo responds that it sounds like the worst possible time for that. Klesko begins to ask where she stashed Maximo when she suddenly sneezes, and after a pause, apologizes. Fidelia asks her if she's actually sorry for killing and vivisecting people, confusing Maximo, but Klesko says that she only killed two of them. Gil was already mostly dead when she found him, that's why she got creative with the number of sigils. The chief had opened him all the way up, and it seemed a shame to let all that material go to waste. Klesko suddenly turns her head and vomits, raising her pistol and saying that she can't get used to this. Fidelia asks why she's doing it then, to which she says that she has to, as she's not dying down here. She remarks that she felt sorriest for Neller, as she can imagine being old and never having found anything, never knowing the secrets and what it all means. She could see herself in his shoes, 20 years from now, desperately clinging to every chance at a new dig site, like it's the last lifeline on Earth. The only thing worse than living that long with nothing to show for it is dying with nothing to show for it. The secrets are here, down here, just like he and Salovey said. She's going to find them, and find the way out, and none of this horror show will have been pointless. Maximo says that none of that explains why she needs to kill them, or why she killed the others. Klesko explains that first of all, Cassidy was right, as she's had a few solid sneezes so far due to having a wicked dust allergy. She honestly did think that she might be able to help them get out of here, and then it would just be Cassidy's word against her, and they saw her shoot the quartermaster and probably Rizwana. They could have walked away from this, the three of them, and they would have dumped Cassidy in a deep hole at Site 06. Fidelia says that she could just not do this, as there's no reason to think it's accomplishing anything. Klesko says that the risk is too great, but Fidelia brings up the risk to her soul. Klesko remarks that if Huff was wrong, and she still had hers after they broke that sarcophagus, well then she sure as hell doesn't have it now, and she doesn't miss it all that much, to be honest. Maximo begs for an explanation of why she needs to kill someone just because she sneezed, She doesn't sound insane, just sad. Plesko explains that she lied when she said that the ancient Davites didn't have any superstitions about sneezing, and she's surprised that nobody, particularly Booth, called her out on that. They had superstitions for everything, and sneezing to the ancient Davites meant that you were faced with a choice: sacrifice or be sacrificed. Everyone else came down here with their extraneous cultural baggage, and she came down here with a crystal clear set of instructions. She didn't want to believe it, and sure as hell didn't want to act on it, but when she saw that look on Russell's face and knew she was about to pull the trigger, that one was easy. Fidelia surmises that she came back to camp early, while Rizwana was asleep, and dragged Panosian out to tear him apart. Plesko reaches behind her back and grabs one of the Davite daggers, which gleams in the worklight glow. She says that that one was hard, as he woke up when she started cutting, and she won't ever forget the sounds he made. Fidelia says that she won't ever forget them either, to which Plesko says that it's much, much better than Neller got. She's interrupted, however, by a spear tip running through her left shoulder, causing her to stumble forward as she clumsily turns. Professor Huff drives her back along the passage and yells for the doctors to run, which they promptly do. Plesko falls to the ground, cursing, and fires her gun twice as the three flee around the corner. One bullet embeds itself in the ceiling. It rumbles, and a cloud of dust falls down. She sneezes again and screams as the cave collapses on top of her. The three survivors stare at the impassable rockfall, and Huff hunches over, clutching his chest. The two doctors say that there's no going back now, but Huff tells them to buck up, as they're in the final stretch and there's no reason to lose faith now. Fidelia says that he's awfully chipper for a man who lost his soul, but he replies that he got it back. He explains that he remembered an old Belarusian saying about the meaning of sneezes, something very much pertinent to their present situation. The Archeom of Sluk believed that outside of profane places, in a natural or sacred setting, sneezing is a way for one's soul, one's true soul, to return to the body. So he proceeded to walk as far as he could walk, to where the dust ended and the stench of dead, rotting things began to fill the stone passages, to where he almost swore he could hear the cries of distant birds, and then he sneezed. He suddenly regards them suspiciously and asks if they've been sneezing, but both promptly deny it. He says that that's good, and he's not sure how much farther they have to go, but he's confident that they'll make it. Maximo asks about him, and he says that he doesn't think so, as he's 74 years old, and rather thinks that he's been shot. He moves his hand to show what is clearly a gunshot wound in his stomach. He tells them that he will come with them a ways, but then they must part. The three travel for just over half an hour before discovering the body of Professor Booth, slumped against the cave wall. He's been apparently exsanguinated by a deep and ragged gash on his right arm and across his chest, but he's smiling. Huff tells them to take his lapel camera, caught between his two fingers as though it were a flower, as he doesn't doubt that Booth recorded something at the end. He could hardly resist the temptation, as he always had a flair for the dramatic, and it's no wonder the BBC lapped him up. Fidelia carefully disconnects the camera, as Huff sits down beside his colleague and closes his eyes. Maximo tells him that they could be almost there, and he could still make it, but Huff says that if they move at his pace, nobody will make it. They'll go, while he will stay here for one final debate with Augustus, and he believes that he'll win this time. He laughs hoarsely and tells them to head for the sun and tell the Foundation what happened, or at least die trying. Huff says nothing more, and after a moment, the two doctors move on. They walk for over an hour in silence until the work lights on the wall appear brighter, as though freshly placed, and the tunnel air is becoming cleaner. The floor is gently sloping upwards, and the cat suddenly appears from behind them, rushing forward and looking back. Maximo tells it not to sneeze, causing Fidelia to laugh, and as they pass by the cat, it begins to walk alongside them. Maximo asks if the cat will be a problem, as it did sneeze multiple times, but Fidelia asks, how would you tell an evil cat from a normal one? She then says that she just figured out what happened, and of course, it would only dawn on her once they were far enough away. It was Huff who set her thinking about it, and then the cat. Huff thought he lost his soul by sneezing, moped about, and then thought he got it back the same way. He came running to save their lives, like he'd gotten a second wind, so sure that old Archeom of Sluck came through for him in a pinch. Back in the beginning, though, Rizwana thought that he had had to wash his hands after he sneezed, or something terrible would happen when he tried to lift the lid. Neller thought you had to say Gesundheit afterwards, or your health would fail. The chief thought he got demons in his head, and then he got demons in his head. It was a trap in the end, a paranoia trap. It was their unfortunate luck that the trap's first opportunity was something so utterly absurd. Maximo asks about Plesko, though, as she was borderline sane and was doing horrible things with method in them, not madness, so why was she different? Fidelia explains that she was a Daevite expert, and anyone who spends that much time studying the evil empire has got to already be evil. We're then provided some details from the final transmission of Captain Cassidy's lapel camera. She's in the clean room, reviewing the camera feed, and occasionally turns to glance at the corpse of Rizwana, revealing a gaping hole where his chest should be. She appears to briefly consider erasing her own camera feed history, aborting the ongoing recordings, or reformatting the entire server, but she doesn't do any of them. She maximizes the feeds from the doctors, now only sporadically received and at a very low bitrate, and watches their escape from the tunnels. She then opens the sealed medical partition, revealing the corpse of the medic covered in burst boils and pustules. She reseals the partition and hangs a biohazard sign on the door before leaving. She then stands at the entrance to the tunnels, watching as the earliest work lights flicker into darkness one by one, truncating the illuminated portion of the passage ahead. A figure can be seen in the far distant shadows, moving towards her at the edge of the dying light. The flickers reflect from something metallic held in the figure's hand. She raises her shotgun, and the figure stops, with the two remaining in this position for over 20 minutes before the figure departs. Cassidy keeps the shotgun raised for another 4 minutes before she begins to back away. She then enters the outer burial chamber, noting the discarded syringes on the floor and the control mechanism for Rizwana's razor device. She picks up the mechanism and climbs up into the open sarcophagus, lying down and raising her shotgun to point at the ceiling. 11 minutes pass, and then she lowers the shotgun and raises the control device. She manipulates the controls, and the lid to the sarcophagus grinds slowly shut. When there is approximately 60 centimeters of open space at her feet, she lowers the controls and raises the shotgun toward the aperture again. 37 minutes pass, at which point she lowers the shotgun again, examines the controls, and slides the lid shut completely. The doctors and the cat reach the end of the tunnels in the early dawn of the eighth day. They see lichen growing on the walls, which are again composed of the Makrana marble seen in the entrance descent. The switchbacks are becoming more regular as they ascend, and the distance between the work lights is farther apart. Fidelia notes that she thinks she can smell the swamp, and Maximo says that he can hear it, and it's getting warmer, too. They turn the corner and are suddenly confronted with unfiltered daylight, emerging from the tunnels at sunset. Maximo blinks rapidly in the light before sneezing, to which Fidelia says, "God bless you." Maximo asks if that will be enough, and Fidelia says that she's sure it will be, because they believe. The doctors were extracted from the site just minutes after their emergence, as Valenti had escaped 20 minutes prior via the same route, and hiked back toward the quarantine post until he was able to make radio contact. All three surviving team members were airlifted for emergency medical treatment and quarantine. The cat was released to Fidelia's custody, subsequent to her debriefing. The reopening and recontainment of the site, primarily via remote manipulation, revealed a number of corpses. Chief Strand had expired from dehydration, Professor Huff from an infected gunshot wound, Captain Cassidy from suffocation, and Dr. Plesko from legs crushed by falling debris and an apparently self-administered insertion of a Davide ritual dagger into her thoracic cavity. Fidelia was summoned for a debriefing by the head of tactical theology, Dr. Liner, once well enough for intercontinental air travel. Liner trusts that Maximo is healing up well, to which she says that that chemical cocktail put one hell of a strain on his system, but it was worth it. Liner notes that her vocabulary seems to have become more colorful in the interim, and she says that she's seen the gradations of sacrilege up close and personal now, so the little things don't seem quite so terrible. He's sorry that she had to learn that way, and moves the discussion to the tomb, calling it a paranoia tomb. He says that it's ontokinetic, meaning reality bending, but she says that it may have imparted ontokinesis on those within it, one or the other, affecting perceived reality, personality, almost certainly probability as well. Neller and the medic gave themselves medical conditions, and Valenti escaped because he thought a sneezing cat was lucky. Liner says that that's almost offensively unlikely, to which Fidelia says that the entire thing is offensive, as it's a direct assault on the concept of faith and other things. Liner says that in her report, it seems that Panosian had the worst of it, as Armenian tradition holds that a second sneeze negates the bad luck of the first. He likely would have been fine, since he believed that and forced himself to sneeze twice instead of only once. Fidelia, however, thinks that the medic takes the cake, since she died of bubonic plague, probably just from remembering a schoolyard song. She's going to have a hard time living with this, though, as 14 people died because a few of them sneezed at inopportune moments, and they all just generated a mini-cult around the vague concept that sneezes were somehow obliterating their humanity, and it became true. Liner says that now she understands their blanket policy against releasing the cause of death to family members. But there is one more loose end to tie up, though. How is it that she was the only one out of a team of 17 members to never sneeze once over the course of a week in a dusty tomb? Fidelia taps her nose and says that she can't due to a nerve injury. Liner smiles and says that they reviewed Booth's last message and plays a snippet for her. In it, he says that here at the end, he finds his historian's instincts, his desire for circuitous closure drawing him back inexorably to the beginning, to Barris Salavi. He left this place a man transformed, as something was taken from him, and he never was able to retrieve it, or perhaps he received a gift he'd never known how much he needed. A purpose, inscrutable, revolutionary, destructive. A fire in the pit where his soul used to be. A fascination with the meaning behind his experience in this tomb, which is now Booth's tomb. He's left with one last question, though. This side effect, this razor focus on the machinations of the ancient Davites. He's seen it in his colleagues, as Neller saw it in Salavi, growing inside of them like the apple in the worm. Was this really just a caltrop to break the bodies and minds of provincial interlopers once the Imperials had absconded back home with whatever treasure they could carry? Or was there a more sinister purpose still to the curse they levied upon this stone? Did they hope to burn all comers, or did they hope that some would be tempered by the flame? Salavi and his ineradicable obsession with a people they tried to strike from his memory burned indelibly into his very soul, where even amnestics could not reach, and nothing but salvation could solve. Was it truly a mere accident, or the point of the exercise entire? Booth will never know, of course, but hopes that someone will, and that they don't learn the hard way. He sneezes, and then chuckles, and says that he thinks sometimes that it's really not so bad to believe in anything much at all, as skepticism has its reward. Though at the close of things, it would be nice to know. Liner hopes that he's at peace, and Fidelia hopes that they all are. Liner asks if she thinks there's anything to it, and if he could be right. Fidelia doesn't know, and it's almost impossible to really judge the hearts and minds of an extinct people. They can't ask them questions, and can only approximate their languages. They don't even know how Latin was originally pronounced, so the Davites and their Devas might as well be aliens. They certainly couldn't have imagined their little farce of sneezing, so it seems a lot more to ask that they might not only have predicted, but actually intended, Salovey and Neller and Plesko's fascinations. She wonders what it got them, if they did want it. One disgraced archaeologist who's never going to see the outside of a cell again, a bunch of dead researchers, techs, and agents, and three healthy people who don't want to hear the word Deva or its derivatives ever again. Liner also mentions the cat as well, and asks if they've given it a name. Fidelia responds that they've named it Gosa, an ancient Davite word meaning to sneeze or to huff. On the day Liner conducted his debriefing, Dr. Salovey managed to escape from Site 06 under suspicious circumstances. On the following day, before Fidelia returned to recover her husband, he also vanished from medical care under equally suspicious circumstances. 2 days after that, a fire at Site 76 destroyed multiple artifacts associated with the Davite Empire. A letter was received at Fidelia's residence in Spain sometime later. In it, the writer first states that he's sorry, and she won't understand this and will take it very hard. But then they cross this section out and instead write that they are not sorry. They are aware, academically, that they should be, but nevertheless the capacity has gone out of them. Perhaps there's a part of them that is still capable of feeling regret, but they have left it far behind. Perhaps it's still screaming through those ever-darkening tunnels, waiting for the last of the work lights to flicker out, one soul among many in search of an empty vessel to fill. Or perhaps the man she married was simply obliterated in a burst of Belarusian sunlight. All he can say by way of comfort, and cold comfort it will be, is that they're finally going to have what they lost so very much in their pursuit of. They're going to find out why the Davites dug that tomb, why and how they did that terrible thing they did to it, and what they hoped thereby to achieve. They're going to find out in a way that does not require faith, which is good, because as she may only now be realizing, he never had too much of that. She wanted to believe that he did, and that was what he wanted as well. He knew how important her faith was to her, as important as she was to him, and if he could exaggerate his purely academic interest into a simulacrum of heartfelt belief, well, where was the harm? Of course, they found out. And for her sake, he wishes that the blessing had worked. For her sake, he wishes that the shadow hadn't stretched out past the mouth of that cave to snatch him away from when it seemed like all was finally well, when she thought it had been enough to stay resolute in the face of evil, when she was wrong. She will have cause to rejoice, though, he promises, because Salovey and him and others of like mind are going to get the answers that their absent friends died grasping at in blind, panicked futility. They're going to learn the secrets of the Devas in full. No conjecture, no theories, no piecing together abstract snippets of trivia, no more puppeteering the past, as this time they're going straight to the source. They're going to ask them. Among the items previously thought destroyed, but now believed to have been stolen, is Site-76 copy of SCP-140. So, unfortunately, Maximo sneezed at the last possible moment for the curse of the tomb to affect him, and lacked the faith in God that his wife had when she blessed him. Now he's convinced that he's no longer the same man, and is hell-bent on bringing back the Daevite Empire through SCP-140 in order to ask them all of the questions that the team wanted to know. It likely won't take a determined individual with a copy of SCP-140 very long to cause some very real problems for the Foundation and the world. SCP-7291 is a lengthy, involved piece that manages to be very entertaining while relying very little on other knowledge of the SCP universe. It heavily involves the Daevite Empire, yes, but not in a way that would be really inextricable to someone that knows nothing about them going in. The idea of a paranoid team of researchers slowly tearing each other apart has certainly been done plenty of times before, although likely never with the plot revolving around sneezing. But the revelation that sneezing was just one paranoid belief among many that became reality is quite unique. While we miss out on a happy ending with the two doctors and their new cat living happily ever after, perhaps there's a way to break the curse in some way, and Maximo will return to normal. Either way, this was quite the wild ride of paranoia, superstitions, and tensions. So remember, if someone sneezes, make sure you say Gesundheit.